You know that feeling, right? You touch something scorching hot and bam, your hand is back before you even, like, properly register the heat.
Oh, yeah, instantly. Or just, you know, how your heart keeps beating. Digestion just happens.
Exactly. All without you thinking about it. It's pretty incredible. So how does the body actually do all that? How does it manage such complex coordination and keep everything running?
It really is something.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're plunging into that ultimate control setup, your nervous system.
Yeah, the master controller.
And our mission for this deep dive, we want to pull out the key ideas from Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman's lectures. Basically, give you a shortcut to really getting this this vital system.
Mm-hmm. A framework for understanding it.
So by the end of our chat today, you should have a much clearer picture of how your body communicates inside, how it processes information.
And how it controls, well, everything from you deciding to move your arm to all those background functions keeping you alive.
And hopefully you'll really appreciate the elegant design Dr. Hoffman highlights.
It is elegant. You know, out of all the body systems, the 11 organ systems, only two are really dedicated control systems.
Okay, which two?
The nervous system, obviously, and the endocrine system. They're the big bosses, constantly working to keep everything stable inside, you know, homeostasis.
Right, keeping all the other nine systems in check.
Exactly. And what's really cool is how they talk to each other. They don't just control other systems, they influence each other too.
Okay, so if they're both about control, they must use signals, right? That's the basic idea.
Fundamentally, yes. Both use signals. But, and this is a key difference Dr. Hoffman points out, the kind of signals they use is quite different.
How so?
Well, the endocrine system, it only uses chemical signals, hormones, you've probably heard of them.
Sure, like insulin or adrenaline.
Right. And these are like global announcements. They get dumped into the bloodstream and travel everywhere.
Okay, broadcast signals. Got it. What about the nervous system then?
The nervous system uses two types. First, it also uses chemical signals, but we call them neurotransmitters.
Neurotransmitters.
Okay. And here's a neat point from Dr. Hoffman. Unlike hormones, these are released right at the target, locally, from the end of a nerve fiber. They don't go into the blood.
So much more targeted communication.
Very targeted, affecting only the cells right nearby. And get this, the exact same chemical can be a hormone in one place and a neurotransmitter somewhere else.
Oh, really? Depending on where it's released.
Exactly. It just shows how efficient the body is.
Okay, so chemical signals, what's the second type?
The second type is electrochemical signals. These are action potentials.
Action potentials. That sounds electric.
It is. Think of them as really rapid, big changes in voltage across the nerve cell membrane carried by ions, those little charged particles.
And not all tissues can do this, right?
Right. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes that only two of the four main tissue types are excitable, meaning they can actually generate and send these action potentials. That's nervous tissue and muscle tissue.
Nervous and muscle. Makes sense. And for the chemical signals, the hormones and neurotransmitters, there's a catch, isn't there?
Absolutely crucial point Dr. Hoffman makes. Any chemical signal needs a receiver. It has to bind to a specifically shaped protein receptor on the target cell.
Like a lock and key.
Precisely. No receptor, no effect. Doesn't matter how much signal is there.
Okay, so let's talk function. How does the nervous system actually operate? Dr. Hoffman lays out three main steps, right?
Yep.
In order.
Yes, a logical flow. First comes sensory input. This is all the information coming in heading towards the central nervous system, the CNS.
Which is the brain and spinal cord.
Just the brain and spinal cord, yes.
And Dr. Hoffman makes a really useful distinction here between sense and sensation, doesn't he? Because we're not aware of everything coming in.
Exactly. Sense is just the raw data. Think blood pressure, pH levels, heart rate, stuff you're thankfully not consciously tracking all the time.
Yeah, that would be overwhelming.
Totally. Sensation, on the other hand, is when that sensory input gets processed high up in the brain and you become aware of it, seeing, hearing, feeling that hot stove, that sensation.
Okay, so sensory input comes first. Then what?
Then comes integration. This is the brain and spinal cord, the CNS, making sense of all that incoming information.
Processing it.
Processing it, comparing it to, like, set points for homeostasis. Is your temperature right? Is your blood sugar okay? It's doing all these unconscious calculations.
Like regulating your heartbeat or digestion.
Perfect examples. And sensation, that conscious awareness, is actually a specific type of integration.
Right. Okay. Input, integration. And the third step.
Motor output. This is the response. Information flowing out from the CNS to the target tissues, the effector organs.
Effectors. Like muscles.
Muscles, yes, but not just skeletal muscles you control voluntarily. Dr. Hoffman points out that motor output also goes to cardiac muscle, your heart.
Smooth muscle, like in your gut.
Yep. And glands actually move when they secrete things, so that counts as motor output too. It's all about initiating a response to maintain that balance, that homeostasis.
Okay, that three-step process makes sense. Now, how is this whole system wired up? Dr. Hoffman breaks it down structurally, right?
Yeah, he does. It's hierarchical. The two major divisions are the central nervous system, CNS.
Brain and spinal cord only.
Only those two. And then everything else, all the nerves branching out, is the peripheral nervous system, PNS.
So cranial nerves coming off the brain, spinal nerves coming off the cord, they're all PNS.
All PNS. And it's important to remember, a nerve isn't one cell. A nerve is like a big cable made of bundles of individual neurons.
Right. Neurons are the cells doing the signaling. Nerves are the bundles carrying them.
Exactly. Now, the PNS itself gets divided based on information flow.
Okay.
You have the sensory division or afferent division. Afferent means arriving, carrying info towards the CNS.
Sensory input coming in.
Correct. And then you have the motor division or efferent division. Efferent means exiting, carrying commands away from the CNS, out to those effector tissues.
Motor output going out. Afferent arrives. Efferent exits. Got it.
And we can subdivide that motor division even further.
Yeah.
Dr. Hoffman explains this clearly.
How's that broken down?
First, the somatic division. Think soma for body. This one controls only skeletal muscles.
The muscles we move on purpose. Voluntary control.
Purely voluntary. You decide. It happens. Then there's the autonomic division.
Auto, like automatic.
Exactly. It manages all the involuntary stuff. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands, things you don't consciously control. The name literally means self-rule.
Your heart rate, digestion, sweating.
All autonomic. And this autonomic system has another layer of division, two parts that often work in opposition.
The sympathetic and parasympathetic.
Precisely. Dr. Hoffman describes them like a dimmer switch. One cranks up activity, think fight or flight, that's sympathetic. The other brings things down, rest and digest, that's parasympathetic.
So they provide fine-tuned antagonistic control over all those involuntary things.
That's the beauty of it. Really precise regulation without you having to think about it.
Okay, we've talked a lot about neurons, the signaling cells. But Dr. Hoffman also highlights the other cells in the nervous system, the neuralia.
Yes, the glial cells. The unsung heroes, really. These are the support crew. Right. They aren't excitable. They don't do the action potentials or neurotransmitters.
But the neurons can't survive without them.
Absolutely essential. And there are different types depending on whether we're in the CNS or the PNS.
Okay, let's start with the CNS, brain, and spinal cord. What kind of glial cells are there?
Dr. Hoffman describes four main types in the CNS. First, astrocytes. These are star-shaped, and they do a critical job. They wrap around capillaries, the tiny blood vessels.
Forming the blood-brain barrier.
Exactly. They form and maintain the blood-brain barrier, the BBB. It's super protective, keeps nasty stuff out of the brain and spinal cord. It also makes it tricky for some drugs to get in.
Right. Okay, astrocytes. What else?
Microglial cells. Think micro. They're small. They're basically the immune cells of the CNS. Phagocytes, they eat debris. Pathogens.
Like little security guards and janitors patrolling and cleaning up.
Good analogy. Then you have ependymal cells. These line the hollow spaces inside the CNS.
The ventricles in the brain and the central canal in the spinal cord.
Yep. And their big job is making cerebrospinal fluid, CSF. That fluid cushion.
We'll definitely come back to CSF. So, astrocytes, microglia, ependymal cells. One more in the CNS.
The oligodendrocytes. These are the myelinators of the CNS. They wrap axons in myelin sheaths.
Myelin. That's the insulation that speeds up signals.
Exactly. It makes signal transmission way faster. And Dr. Hoffman points out the name oligo means a few, or not many. One oligodendrocyte branches out and myelinates sections of multiple neuron axons.
Efficient. And that myelinin is what makes white matter look white.
Precisely. Oligodendrocytes create the white matter in the brain and spinal cord.
Okay, those are the CNS neuroglia. What about out in the periphery, the PNS?
Two main types Dr. Hoffman focuses on. The big ones are Schwann cells, also called neurolemmocytes. They do the same job as oligodendrocytes myelination, but in the PNS.
So they insulate axons in peripheral nerves. Is there a difference in how they do it?
Yes. Unlike oligodendrocytes that cover multiple axons, one Schwann cell wraps around only one segment of one axon in the PNS. It takes many Schwann cells lined up to cover a whole axon.
Okay, and the gaps between these Schwann cells are important, right?
Hugely important. Those gaps are the nodes of Ranvier. Dr. Hoffman explains this really well. myelin forces the action potential to jump from node to node.
Like skipping dominoes.
Exactly like skipping dominoes. It's called saltatory conduction. Much, much faster than going step by step along the whole axon membrane.
Makes sense. Faster signaling. What's the other PNS glial cell?
Satellite cells. These cover the cell bodies of neurons located in the PNS ganglia. Their function is a bit less understood than Schwann cells, but they provide support.
Okay, so a whole support crew, the neuroglia backing up the neurons. Now let's think about how information travels. You mentioned spinal nerves earlier. How does the in and out flow work there?
Right, Dr. Hoffman uses the spinal nerve structure to illustrate this. Each spinal nerve connects to the spinal cord via two roots, the posterior root.
Posterior means back, right?
Yes, the back root. It carries only sensory information into the spinal cord. It's purely afferent.
Okay, sensory is the back.
And the anterior root, the front root, carries only motor information out of the spinal cord. Purely efferent.
Motor out the front, so one-way streets are the roots.
Exactly. These one-way roots then merge together just outside the spinal cord to form the main spinal nerve, which is therefore a two-way street, carrying both sensory and motor neurons bundled together.
But inside that bundle, each individual neuron is still strictly one-way.
Always. An afferent neuron never carries motor signals, and vice versa.
Got it. Now, thinking about sensory input, especially from the skin, Dr. Hoffman describes different receptor types.
Yes, different structures for sensing different things. The simplest are just free nerve endings, basically bare dendrites.
What do they sense?
Primarily pain from damage, excessive pressure, or extreme temperatures. They let you know when something's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Then there are more complex ones.
Yep. Closer to the surface, in the dermis, you have Meissner's corpuscles. These are sensitive to light, touch, or pressure.
Like feeling the texture of fabric, or maybe individual paintbrush bristles.
That's a perfect example Dr. Hoffman uses, feeling those fine details. Then, deeper down, you find lamellar corpuscles, also called Pacinian corpuscles.
Lamellar means layered, right? Like an onion.
Exactly. They look like tiny onions under a microscope. Because they're deeper and have that structure, they respond only to deeper pressure or vibration.
So not light touch, but more significant pressure.
Right. And then there's another whole category of sensory input Dr. Hoffman discusses, proprioceptors.
Proprioception. That's knowing where your body parts are without looking.
Exactly. Your sense of body position and movement. It comes from receptors in your muscles, tendons, and joints. Two key ones he highlights.
Go on.
The Golgi tendon organ. These are found in the tendons where muscle attaches to bone.
What do they detect?
They sense tension. If a muscle pulls too hard on its tendon, risking damage, the Golgi tendon organ fires. It triggers a reflex to relax the muscle.
A protective mechanism.
Very much so. And it also contributes to your general sense of proprioception, how much force your muscles are exerting.
Okay. And the other key proprioceptor?
The muscle spindle. These are actually embedded within the muscle fibers themselves.
What's their job?
They detect stretch. When a muscle is stretched, the spindle sends a signal back to the spinal cord. And this, as Dr. Hoffman explains, triggers a reflex contraction of that same muscle.
Is that the knee-jerk reflex?
That's the classic example. Tapping the patellar tendon stretches the quad muscle, the muscle spindle fires, and the quad contracts, making your leg kick. It's a stretch reflex.
Fascinating. Okay, let's get down to the nitty-gritty, the actual nerve signal, the action potential. Dr. Hoffman starts with the baseline, the resting state.
Right, the resting membrane potential. And this isn't just nerve and muscle cells. All your cells maintain this. It's a voltage difference across the cell membrane.
More positive outside, more negative inside.
Generally, yes. And maintaining this difference takes energy. It relies heavily on ion pumps constantly working, especially the sodium-potassium pump.
And Dr. Hoffman mentions something staggering about the energy cost of these pumps.
It's mind-blowing. He points out that something like 40% of the calories you consume go just to power these sodium-potassium pumps across your body.
40%. Just keeping cells ready to signal or do their jobs. Wow.
It underscores how absolutely fundamental this electrical potential is.
Okay, so that's the resting state. What happens when a neuron fires? How is an action potential generated?
It's a dramatic, rapid reversal of that resting potential. When the neuron is stimulated enough, special channels called voltage-gated sodium channels slam open.
Sodium ions. Those are positive, right? And usually more concentrated outside.
Exactly. So when those channels open, positively charged sodium ions rush into the cell, down their concentration gradient.
Making the inside suddenly become positive relative to the outside.
Very briefly, yes. That's the spike of the action potential.
And then it travels. How does it move down the axon? Propagation.
This is where Dr. Hoffman's dominoes falling analogy is perfect. The voltage change from one small patch of membrane triggers the opening of voltage-gated sodium channels in the patch right next to it.
So one action potential triggers the next, which triggers the next.
Yeah.
All the way down.
Precisely. And crucially, it doesn't fade out. It gets regenerated at full strength at each step, no matter how long the axon is. It's an all-or-nothing signal.
Okay, so the signal travels down the axon. What happens when it reaches the end? The synapse.
Ah, synaptic transmission. This is where the signal passes from one neuron to the next or to a target cell. Dr. Hoffman outlines the steps clearly.
Let's walk through them.
Okay. First, the action potential arrives at the axon terminal, the end of the presynaptic neuron.
Presynaptic meaning before the synapse.
Right. This voltage change opens different voltage-gated channels. Calcium channels.
Okay, now calcium comes into play.
Calcium ions flow into the axon terminal. This calcium influx is the trigger for the next step. It causes vesicles, little sacs filled with neurotransmitter molecules, to fuse with the axon terminal membrane and release their contents into the synaptic cleft.
The tiny gap between the neurons. So neurotransmitters get dumped into the gap.
Yeah, through a process called exocytosis. These neurotransmitter molecules, the chemical signal, then diffuse across that tiny synaptic cleft.
And find receptors on the other side.
Exactly. They bind to specific chemically gated ion channel receptors on the membrane of the postsynaptic neuron, the neuron after the synapse.
Chemically gated, meaning the neurotransmitter is the key that opens them.
Perfect. When the neurotransmitter binds, these channels open. Often, they're sodium channels.
So sodium rushes into the postsynaptic neuron now.
Yep. That influx of positive ions creates a voltage change in the postsynaptic neuron. If it's strong enough, it triggers a new action potential in that second neuron.
And the signal continues. It's amazing how the signal changes form.
Dr. Hoffman really highlights that transformation. Electrochemical, the action potential traveling down the axon.
Then chemical, the neurotransmitter crossing the synapse.
Then back to electrochemical, the new action potential starting in the next neuron.
Incredible. But what stops the signal? If neurotransmitters just stayed in the cleft, wouldn't the postsynaptic neuron keep firing?
Excellent point. That would cloud the signal. There are mechanisms to clear the neurotransmitter quickly. Often, enzymes in the cleft break it down rapidly.
So the binding is temporary, the signal is brief and distinct.
Exactly. Ensures precise information transfer.
And just to connect back, that final neuron, the postsynaptic cell, could be another neuron. Or it could be one of those effector tissues we talked about.
Right. It could be synapsing onto skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or even a gland cell.
And Dr. Hoffman noted that signals to glands can trigger hormone release, right?
Yeah.
Linking the nervous and endocrine systems again.
Yes. A perfect example of how the two control systems interact and influence each other.
Okay. Let's zoom out a bit and look at the brain itself. Dr. Hoffman walks through the major regions. The biggest part is obvious.
The cerebrum. Huge, wrinkly, dominates the view. Those wrinkles are the sulci, the valleys, and gyre, the ridges. They increase surface area.
More surface area for processing power. Is there a key landmark, Dr. Hoffman points out?
The central sulcus. It's a major groove running roughly down the middle, side to side. It's important because it divides major functional areas.
How so?
The gyrus, or ridge, just in front of the central sulcus, the precentral gyrus, is the primary motor cortex. It's where voluntary movements are initiated and calculated.
Motor in the front. What about behind it?
The gyrus just behind the central sulcus, the postcentral gyrus, is the primary somatosensory cortex. This is where general sensory information like touch, temperature, pressure first arrives for conscious processing.
Wait, three in the back. Got it. And the cerebrum has lobes, right?
Yep. Four main ones in each hemisphere, named after the skull bones covering them. Frontal, parietal, temporal, and occipital. And that outer layer of the cerebrum, the gray stuff.
The cerebral cortex. That's where the main thinking happens.
A huge amount of the processing, yes, the gray matter.
Okay, besides the cerebrum, what are other major parts Dr. Hoffman covers?
The cerebellum means little brain. It's the second largest part tucked underneath the back of the cerebrum.
That's its main job.
Coordination. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes its role in smoothing out and fine-tuning motor movements, balance, posture, think muscle memory, coordinating a golf swing or playing piano.
Okay, cerebellum for coordination. What else?
The thalamus. It's deep inside. Dr. Hoffman calls it the brain's switchboard or relay station.
Why a switchboard?
Because almost all sensory information heading to the cerebral cortex goes through the thalamus first. It gets sorted, filtered, and relayed to the appropriate cortical area.
Important traffic controller. below the thalamus.
The hypothalamus. Hypo means below. It's small but mighty. A really key link between the nervous system and the endocrine system, as we mentioned. It controlled hormone release from the pituitary gland, regulates body temp, hunger, thirst, lots of vital homeostatic functions.
Nervous endocrine connection point and the base of the brain.
The brainstem connects the cerebrum and cerebellum to the spinal cord, includes parts like the pons and the medulla oblongata. The medulla is basically the official bottom of the brain. It controls essential functions like breathing and heart rate.
Okay, that covers the main structures.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Hoffman addresses that old myth, right? The we only use 10% of our brains thing.
Oh, yeah. He definitely debunks that. It's completely false. While you don't use every single neuron all at once, that would be chaos, a seizure, basically.
Right. Not desirable.
Your brain is incredibly active metabolically. All parts have functions. It's constantly working, consuming a huge amount of energy, mostly glucose. Dr. Hoffman notes how the body prioritizes glucose for the brain, especially under stress.
So we use all of it, just not all at the same instant. Good to know. What about how different body parts are represented in the cortex? The homunculus.
Ah, yes, the cortical homunculus. It's that distorted map Dr. Hoffman shows. It illustrates how much cortical area is devoted to sensory input from or motor control to different body parts.
And it looks weird because it's not proportional to body size, right?
Exactly. Hands, lips, tongue areas with fine motor control or high sensitivity get huge amounts of brain real estate, represented as massive parts on the homunculus, feet, trunk, much smaller representation.
Really visualizes where the processing power goes. Now, Dr. Hoffman also talked about types of connections within the brain based on where the neurons go.
Right, the pathways, the fibers. Association fibers connect different areas within the same cerebral hemisphere, like linking vision areas with language areas on the left side.
Okay, staying on one side, what about crossing over?
Those are commissural fibers. They connect corresponding areas in the two different hemispheres. The biggest bundle of these, as Dr. Hoffman highlights, is the massive corpus callosum. It lets the left and right brain talk to each other.
Connecting the hemispheres.
And the longest ones.
Projection fibers. These connect the cerebrum down to lower brain areas in the spinal cord or carry sensory info up. They project out of the cerebrum.
Got it. Association within, commissural across, projection up and down. And just to recap the gray versus white matter, easy reminder based on Dr. Hoffman's explanation. Gray matter is mostly neuron cell bodies, dendrites, and unmyelinated axons. It's where the processing happens, often found on the surface, cortex, or in deep nuclei. White matter is primarily myelinated axons bundles, made white by the myelin from oligodendrocytes in the CNS. It's the transmission tracts connecting different gray matter areas, usually deeper in the brain.
Okay, clear distinction. Now let's talk about that fluid cushion Dr. Hoffman mentioned, the CSF. Where is it found?
It's in those hollow spaces within the CNS Dr. Hoffman described, the four ventricles inside the brain, two large lateral ones, a third and a fourth, which are all connected, and that system continues down into the central canal running through the middle of the spinal cord.
So fluid-filled cavities inside, and it's made there.
It's produced by those specialized ependymal cells we mentioned earlier, clustered in structures called choroid plexuses, which are found within the ventricles.
And its main job is protection.
Absolutely. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes its role as a shock absorber. It provides buoyancy. Your brain basically floats in CSF, which protects it from banging against the skull during normal movements or minor impacts.
Like his analogy of an egg in water.
Exactly. The water cushions the egg. CSF cushions the brain and spinal cord. It also helps circulate nutrients and remove waste products.
Does it just sit there or does it flow?
Oh, it flows continuously. It's constantly being produced in the ventricles, circulates through all those internal cavities, and also flows out to surround the outside of the brain and spinal cord in the subarachnoid space.
Cushioning inside and out. Where does it go eventually?
It eventually gets reabsorbed back into the bloodstream through structures called arachnoid granulations. So there's constant production, circulation, and drainage, maintaining the right pressure and keeping the fluid fresh.
A dynamic fluid system.
Okay.
Okay, let's shift back out to the peripheral network. Dr. Hoffman talked about nerve structure again, specifically in the PNS.
Right, just to reinforce how peripheral nerves are organized. Similar to muscles, they have bundles within bundles. Individual axons are wrapped in endoneurium, bundles of axons, fascicles, are wrapped in perineurium, and the whole nerve is wrapped in epineurium. Connective tissue sheath for support and protection.
And myelination out here is done by?
Schwann cells, remember. One Schwann cell per segment of one axon.
Got it. Now, Dr. Hoffman mentioned the two main types of peripheral nerves, cranial and spinal.
Correct. The 12 pairs of cranial nerves emerge directly from the brain. They serve the head and neck primarily, but also some thoracic and abdominal organs, like the vagus nerve.
And are they sensory, motor, or both?
Some are purely sensory, like the optic nerve for vision. Some are mainly motor, like nerves controlling eye movement. And some are mixed, containing both sensory and motor neurons, as Dr. Hoffman points out. But again, within a mixed nerve, each neuron is still one way.
Okay, and the spinal nerves?
These emerge from the spinal cord, 31 pairs, named for the region they come from, cervical, thoracic, lumbar, sacral, costigial. They serve the rest of the body below the head.
And sometimes they form networks, plexuses.
Yes, especially the nerves serving the limbs. They branch and rejoin in complex networks called plexuses, like the brachial plexus for the arm or the lumbosacral plexus for the leg. This allows signals from multiple spinal cord levels to reach specific limb muscles.
Okay, one last key distinction Dr. Hoffman makes is in the wiring of the motor system, comparing somatic and autonomic again.
Yes, structurally it's quite different. The somatic motor system, the voluntary one going to skeletal muscle, uses a single motor neuron. Its cell body is in the CNS, brainstem or spinal cord, and its long axon goes all the way directly to the target skeletal muscle fiber.
One neuron from CNS to muscle. Simple. How does the autonomic system differ?
The autonomic nervous system, involuntary to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle glands, always uses two neurons in series to reach the target.
Two neurons. How does that work?
There's a presynaptic neuron with its cell body in the CNS. Its axon extends out and synapses with a postsynaptic neuron in a ganglion, a cluster of neuron cell bodies, outside the CNS. Then the axon of that postsynaptic neuron travels the rest of the way to the target effector organ.
So a two-neuron relay chain. With a synapse happening outside the CNS.
Exactly. That's true for both the sympathetic and parasympathetic divisions.
And just to remind ourselves, those two divisions provide that.
Antagonistic control. That fine-tuned push-pull regulation of all our involuntary bodily functions.
Wow. Okay, that was quite the journey through the nervous system. We really unpacked a lot from Dr. Hoffman's lectures.
We did, from the basic signals and cell types to the major structures and functional divisions.
We saw how it senses the world. Integrates that information and generates responses, both conscious and unconscious, how it's all wired together, CNS and PNS, somatic and autonomic.
And the crucial support from the neuroglia, the CSF cushion. It's an incredibly complex and elegant system.
Absolutely. And that fact you mentioned earlier from Dr. Hoffman about the energy cost.
Yeah, the 40% of your food budget just powering those ion pumps for the resting potential. It's staggering.
It really highlights the constant the sheer work involved in just being ready, let alone doing complex thought or movement.
It really does. So much happening quietly behind the scenes.
So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. Considering this intricate design Dr. Hoffman reveals, for both, you know, thinking and just living, what new appreciation do you have for all that silent, constant work your nervous system is doing right now, making your life possible?
It definitely gives you pause, makes you appreciate the complexity within.
Absolutely. Keep exploring. Keep asking questions. Keep diving deep.